Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio. This is our fourth Wednesday Tucson Sisters in Crime show. We've been doing this all year, and it's been so much fun. And our very first guest was Eva Eldridge, who is who started this whole thing. She's like, you got to have the Tucson Sisters on the show. So we said, okay, well, we'll do it every fourth Wednesday. And the very first show we had Elaine Powers on. She's a writer and author, Elaine A. Powers. And so we thought, hey, she's got to come back on and we've got to hear all about what she does, more about, you know, but I do want to say everyone should go look at TucsonSistersInCrime.org. It's an amazing organization. Whether you read mystery, you love mystery, you write mystery, or maybe you're a criminal. I don't know. Check it out because it's a really cool community of mystery writers. And Nancy and I think Nancy, have we had more fun? That we had no idea how much fun we were going to have with this series of shows.
I love it because I always think, okay, so how did somebody decides to murder somebody else?
Oh, we're back into murder in the desert.
I know. Well, because and it's interesting how each book that develops the wherewithal with why the person felt they had to do that and what happens after. Mm-hmm. And then the people surrounding the mystery. And sometimes you just want to say, wake up, dude, can't you see it? Because, you know what I mean? Because they're like, come on, it's kind of obvious, but it's not to the character involved. So you're like looking from above into the book, and depending on who's writing it, it's apparent right away or maybe not so apparent until later. But it always is, to me, intriguing.
Especially in the desert. So welcome back, Elaine. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Good.
It's getting a little cooler here in Tucson, so it's nice to have the windows open for a change.
Yeah, I mean, the fall season in Tucson is amazing. You know, fall through winter and then spring. I mean, I love Tucson, period. Actually, I don't care what season it is. It's because you get to have five seasons. You know, monsoon season versus summer season. It's still summer, but you get two summers, basically.
That's true. Dry summer and the wet summer.
Yeah. I love it. And you guys had a good wet summer this year.
Oh, we had a fabulous monsoon season this year. Last year, we had no rain and the saguaros were dying. This year, we were the third wettest in recorded monsoon history. So everything's lush and green.
And the saguaros get fat. They get fat.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, all the cacti are plump and happy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
Nice to know.
This is really interesting. Nancy's talking about, you know, murders and dead bodies. She will talk to you about dead bodies in a desert for years. She gets all into that. I mean, you need to start writing something, Nancy, obviously. But, you know, what you do is you've written a number of children's books. You talk about, we're actually recording this on National Reptile Day, which I think is funny because we even had to reschedule from some technical things. And now here we are on Reptile Day talking with you because you got iguanas and lizards and snakes and all kinds of things going on in your books. And you work with children, you know, children's books too. So I want to start off with, where's the mystery for you? Because I know you're also a co-founder of Tucson Sisters in Crime.
Yes, I am. I started out to write murder mysteries. I had some ideas for mysteries that involved animals being blamed for deaths that people actually caused. And it was a reptile that was going to be suspected. And as an iguana rescuer, the protagonist was going to prove that, in fact, it was a human who had killed the person and not the innocent reptile and saved the reptile's life. Well, along the way, I got writing about reptiles in adventure tales. And I kind of swerved over into children's books. But I discovered that crafting a children's book is just like crafting a murder mystery. Mm-hmm. It's got a story arc. It has to build to a climax that's resolved. And this is true even with rhyming picture books. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out with the general easy stuff and then you build to the more dangerous parts. And then you have a nice fun closing.
But it's still hard with kids. I think kids' books have got to be some of the hardest to write because you have to keep their attention because they're, you know what I mean? That's harder in a way.
And you have to think like a four-year-old.
I think my mind is
stuck as a four-year-old.
I'm with you.
because the words you use, the energy has to be in every sentence. You know, you have to make it exciting for the kids to read. You can't just write like you're writing for a small adult, because how we write for adults is very, very different than how you need to write for children. Mm. And that's one of the reason in my picture books I went with the rhyming, because the poetry brings the lyricism to the words and the phrases, which also keeps kids' attention. Mm. They like the flow of words. And, you know, introduces them to a little poetry along the way. And, you know, it kind of helps their parents making a little more interesting when they
I think for the parents, they have to go, okay, maybe I'm going to add a little rap in there. You know, I'm going to add something in there, because the parents, you know, and I think this last couple of years for parents, suddenly they're teachers and parents and, you know, balancing careers and everything's changed. So with what you're doing, I think that is absolutely amazing, because it just having that flow, that rhythm, we need that. And I think this, like I said, these last couple years, parents need all the help they can get. Also, what I love is that you are incorporating the natural world. And yes, the natural world right now is very threatened. Is that part of why you do it, what you write about too? I mean, especially reptiles. You know, I think reptiles, like I know when I put up photos of snakes, even alligators, people are like,
everybody's like, ew.
Exactly.
If I do spiders, ew, and I'm going, but they do this, they're so cool. So we have to somehow bridge that gap of fear.
Exactly. It started off innocently enough. I was working at a citizen scientist with the Shedd Aquarium's iguana research projects in the Bahamas, specifically in Wardrick Wells, which is the Exuma Land and Sea Park. And I happened to spend an afternoon with a couple of my friends with a curly-tailed lizard. And unlike most curly-tailed lizards, this lizard hung out with us. He climbed up on our shoes. Very unusual behavior for a lizard. And it got the storyline going in my head about this was Curtis. And you have to boat into Wardrick Wells. You can't get there by plane can't drive there. And so he was pondering, you know, where are all these tourists coming from? And so he jumps on their boat and goes to the big city of Nassau, looks around, decides he wants to go home again. But, you know, as I said, there has to be climax. Getting on the boat was easy, but getting off the boat back to his island was going to be a little riskier. Well, along with just telling this adventure tale, I also incorporated the ecosystems and the ecology and the history of Wardrick Wells. And when it was finished, we realized that this was a great way to educate children in a way that was fun. You know, a lot of kids say, oh, I don't like science. It's so dull and boring. This was a way of making it fun. So that's what started the Curtis Curlytail series. And then the next in the series was Curtis Curlytail, Here's a Hutia, which is a choose your own ending book about how would you solve the problem when an endangered species, the Hutia, damages a protected environment. Because the Hutia were thought to be extinct. And then they found a small colony of them on a little tiny island. And they realized, you know, a bad storm, some introduced disease would wipe out the entire population. So they took some of the Hutia and moved them to Wardrick Wells in the national park, where they did really, really well. And being herbivores, they basically ate all the vegetation on the island. So, you know, that's not exactly what they wanted to happen. So I introduced the concept of, okay, you've got a scientific problem. how would you solve it?
Right.
And so I included three endings, which I am now pleased to say that the Bahamas have actually incorporated all three in their efforts to save the Hutia, as well as Wardrobe Wells. And then, you know, and then I went on to poaching and all of these really serious topics that can be presented in a fun, entertaining way. Mm. Well, I live in Arizona and there isn't a real big demand for books about the Bahamas. So that got me started on my picture book series. And the first one was requested by my tortoise named Myrtle. She was an adopted tortoise.
We can't say Myrtle the turtle, though. It's Myrtle. Yes.
Well, that's what she got tired of being called. Everybody say, oh, Myrtle the turtle.
I know.
I'm a tortoise.
And there's a difference.
There is a difference. And most people think they know, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who say, oh, I know the difference. I say, okay, give me one. Mm. Only three times have people answered correctly. They've gotten a true difference between turtles and tortoises. And so I came up with this rhyming picture book that it actually has nine differences in there. And it was a lot of fun. So it got me thinking, okay, there are other animals that could benefit for this. And the one I was requested to write specifically by the herpetologist in the area was about rattlesnakes.
Oh, really cool.
Everybody fears a rattlesnake.
The fear factor of a rattlesnake. But if people understand how crucial they are to the landscape, if you don't want little rats in your car eating your car wires, you need to understand the benefits of a rattlesnake.
As well as the spread of disease.
Yes.
You know, those rodents are spreading disease.
Yeah.
And here in the Sonoran Desert, they're very serious diseases. So, and you know, a lot of people will just look at a photograph of a rattlesnake and just be terrified. So I figured, okay, let me present them in a fun, colorful way. This book has great illustrations, very colorful. And the illustrations aren't threatening. You know, it's just a colored picture of a rattlesnake. And it is actually one of my better sellers because people really do want to understand them so that their first instinct isn't to just automatically kill the rattlesnake.
Right. You know, I want to go back to what you talked about iguanas too, because Nancy and I were talking about iguanas and we've been in Florida recently where there's iguanas and there's anoles and all these amazing lizards. And of course, the desert Southwest has just incredible lizards, collared lizards and chameleons. And, you know, I love watching, you know, and we lived in Africa.
In the wild.
And watching chameleons out in Africa. We were really privileged. And snakes. Well, we have snake stories for sure.
Yeah, we have snake stories.
So, but we were talking about iguanas and, you know, I'm like, well, I'm not nervous about iguanas. It's monitor lizards that I was always like walking to school in one place that we live, like the monitor lizards came out, they could whack you with their tails.
They're big.
And I remember as kids, we had to all watch out for monitor lizards. And maybe I think we spooked each other out more than what the monitor lizard cared to. But they
there's a huge difference between a monitor lizard and an iguana.
Yeah, we were just
talking about. Iguanas are like 16 to 18 inches.
Oh, no.
Monitor lizards are like feet.
They're coming at you. They will go at you.
Let me correct you on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Green iguanas reach over 6 feet in length.
Well, I've never seen that, you know. My parents had iguanas, but they're always small.
That's because we don't take very good care of our captive iguanas. We think if we keep them in small enclosures, they'll stay small, but they don't. They just die. So
I've never seen a 6 foot iguana. I would love to see that.
I could go grab one for you.
Everybody, wait. I'm going to pause this. Hold on. I'm going to pause this so you can. Okay, we have Elaine back. We paused that so she could get her iguana. Now, Nancy, that is not a little iguana. That's a big boy. Is that a big boy or a big girl?
This is a boy. He's a rock iguana, but he's representing all the iguanas, like the green iguanas. They get just as long.
And as you can see,
wow,
he is over 5 feet long.
How did you end up with him? Oh, my gosh.
There he goes. So as I'm standing here, his tail is on the ground.
He is like the, he is like, you know, like hugging a cat.
But yes.
Like almost like bigger in a way. Like this is a dog.
So,
like when I'm just trying to, for those who are just listening instead of seeing, that
that's huge.
He's a big boy.
His head is as big as yours.
Oh, but he's so cool. Like he's like the never ending story. You know? Oh my gosh. I wanna talk to him.
Get him.
Hello.
But so he's raised in captivity?
Yes, yes. I've had him since he was a hatchling. He was bred here. He's actually a hybrid because he's a hybrid of the endangered Cayman blue iguana. You're not legally allowed to own any purebred blue iguanas, you know, as a private person. So, it, you know, there's controversy on whether it was done accidentally or intentionally, but they bred it with another iguana, which makes them available for the pet trade. So he's one of the few iguanas I actually bought. And I had him as a hatchling. He came from California. He was supposedly shipped overnight to New Jersey, but he got lost in parcel post. So it took him 8 days to reach me. And we were afraid he was going to be dead on arrival. But as you see, it has not stunted his growth at all.
Wow.
Iguanas are tough animals. They really are very tough animals, which is why they're able to be so invasive. But a rock iguana and a blue iguana or a green iguana can easily be 5 to 6 feet long. So that's 2 meters.
He is big. Yes, okay, I'm going to let you go. Put him back, and everybody stay tuned. All right, we're back with Elaine, and so what we want to touch on is Elaine. You have this big boy. He's a big boy, but you talked about how you got him and how he went through quite a trial to get to you. So let's talk about the pet trade, like you're saying, because there's good and bad with this. So tell us a little bit about that part.
Okay. I personally don't recommend iguanas for pets for most people. I had an iguana rescue in New Jersey, which is why I had the setup for iguanas. And iguanas are not socialized animals. They are fully wild animals. They will always be fully wild animals.
Yeah.
So they're not like a dog or cat that's going to automatically like you. And as a wild animal, they're a prey animal. So everything eats an iguana. So they're naturally very afraid of a large mammal who comes up and wants to hold them and pet them and love them. It's just a large mammal coming in to eat them. So they're going to respond. And as they were talking about how the monitor lizards whip, iguanas' tails are very effective whips and can actually break bones.
I believe that now.
And the other part, the other defensive part they have is that they have razor sharp teeth. Now, these are animals that have to bite through fibrous plant material. And so, you know, you look in their mouth and you can't really see them, but their mouths are little razor blades. And when you get bitten, you'll have a complete outline of all the teeth in whatever part of your body has been bitten. And they bite hard and they bite like they mean it. So unless you
mean it,
spend a year trying to convince a wild animal that they can trust you and like you and that you really want a 6 foot, 20 pound lizard, an iguana isn't for you.
And you know? And isn't that also the same as tortoises and turtles too, that they live really long years? I mean, like 90 plus years. That I don't know how long an iguana's life is. I've never thought of owning one, but some of these reptiles will outlive you. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And the problem with the green iguanas is they have a normal lifespan of about 15 to 20 years. In the pet trade, 98% of them are dead within the first year.
Oh,
and 99% of them are dead within 2 years.
Oh, that's awful.
Because people don't want to take the time to get the nutritious leafy vegetables that you have to chop up every day. The
the UVB lights that provide the full spectrum sunlight that they need to be able to make bones are very expensive. And you need a huge space. These are not things you can stick in a 20-gallon aquarium. Matter of fact, even a hatchling is too big for a 20-gallon aquarium. So unless you're willing to put in 15 to 20 years of your life serving this wild animal who may or may not ever really like you, don't look at it.
Well, this is, I really love what you're saying, because it's, but isn't it about really the end of the day, we should be saving their habitat for them to be wild, and you can go see them and go like, dude, look at that. That's so cool.
And unfortunately it's through the pet trade that the green iguanas have become invasives around the world.
Oh, wow.
So that's one of the big pushes in iguana conservation now, is getting the green iguanas away from the environments where the other iguanas live, because so, they are so aggressive.
So is that kind of like what's happening in the Everglades with the pythons and things?
Well, and the green iguanas in Florida, those are not natives. And people always comment, you know, when it gets cold in the winter and the iguanas become comatose and fall out of the trees, people are always saying, oh, Elaine, don't you want to go down and save them? No, actually, I'd rather go down and finish the job. They're already unconscious. Let's just take them to the rest, because they don't belong there. They're damaging the ecosystem for the animals and plants that do belong there.
Yeah.
Now, I'll happily support the preservation of their native environment. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They're actually one of the animals that can be sustainably grown to provide food for people, but also to, you know, have enough in the habitat. And so in their proper place, you know, and that's the problem with taking wild animals as pets, is in the proper place, they've got all the checks and balances. They serve a purpose there. They're part of the ecosystem. And when we take them, and you know, I'm guilty of this too, selfishly wanting them in my world, then it's up to me to give them the best life possible. And that means making sure I get them to the vet when they need to be, making sure they have.
And having a place where a vet that can do that.
Exactly. And, you know, and there aren't many vets out there who are reptile experts.
Exactly.
No, so, they're not. But I agree with you. But the only thing I would change in this whole thing is I don't believe, because humanity did this, the iguanas didn't do it, that they should be exterminated. I think they should be put back to where they belong rather than exterminated.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
I know that's expensive and whatever.
Actually, there's a much bigger danger to doing that. Is because we've taken them out of their environment, we've introduced them to other diseases that they don't have back in their nature.
Yeah, really true.
So a lot of the animals, like our Sonoran Desert tortoises that are in the foster program in this state, you can't return them in the wild because they'll take back diseases to the native populations. So unfortunately, you know, and I'm all in favor of if you really decide you need a green iguana in your life, go to your local pet rescue.
To your local bar and find one there.
Those are a different kind of lizard.
Yeah, and not for kids, Nancy. She's messing with you. But I think you're right about go to the rescue.
Yeah.
But it really is you know, we pet sit and travel, you know, as we travel full time across country, we pet sit. And we've had some interesting sits with tortoises, and we go, like, that's really how you're caring? So you look it up, like, are you not putting water with your tortoise? And there's this war of feeding your tortoise water or not. And I'm going, is it going to kill them to have water near them? I think in nature, if they had water near them, they'll be fine. They're not going to know to overdrink their water, you know? So it's a very interesting thing, and I like, if you're not rescuing, what are you doing? You know what I mean? That's what I want to say to people. And you've come from the rescue background, and I think it's really important that we understand all these different species and understand, like, we should fix their habitat.
But educate the education before you get a pet,
right,
is critical, especially if you're going to go outside of dog and cat. And from our experience, even before you get dog and cat, you need to educate yourself as kind of dog, kind of cat. Where do you live? What do they need versus what you are ready to offer? Mm-hmm. Because you don't need a Great Dane in a small apartment with no yard. You know, it's about what you think you want and later becomes a big problem. Just research first and think it through. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying don't go get one. I'm saying think it through and make sure you have the absolute everything that that pet will need to survive and not get sick.
And put their welfare ahead of your own convenience.
Exactly.
Yes. You were saying something. One advantage of going to a rescue is you get to meet the animal. I ran an iguana rescue in New Jersey for many years. And it was important that the adopters came to meet the iguanas because once they passed the application form, which asked the question, do you mind being bitten, scratched, and whipped? which is the point I lost most adopters, fortunately. Wow. They would come and I would be thinking, okay, you know, Joe Iguana here is probably going to be the one they want. No, the iguana chooses the adopter, you know, and that's how I suspect it is for many animals, is they're the ones doing the choosing. They're going, okay, these are the humans I want to go home with.
That's interesting. And I think what is wonderful with what you're doing, you're bringing them into life because there's this whole thing with reptiles and fish of they're cold-blooded, they don't care. We talked about this before, you know, they do care. They do have feelings. I believe this whole thing of just throwing fish back in the water that they don't feel anything. I really don't believe in that. I know that there was that dude way back land that said, no, this is a true thing. He did this. I really hate that I don't have it on the top of my head right now of who it was, but he was a dude way back when, this is the best you're going to get on this, that said animals were cold-blooded. And it was for a whole other reason that he did it. And it was propaganda.
When we say somebody's cold-blooded, we now, because this is fiction, cold-blooded doesn't mean that their blood run is actually lower than 97.8, I think is our body temperature that your blood's supposed to run at. We mean they're mean and they're a murderer.
Right. Yes.
And so we now take that to when we say this animal's cold-blooded, that's two separate things.
Yes.
An animal, it's totally two different body types. Doesn't mean they're mean.
No.
It just means their system runs different.
Cold-blooded means that they regulate their body temperature based on the environmental temperature.
Exactly.
They're ectothermic. They don't produce their own heat energy.
Exactly.
So that's the difference between reptiles, fish, amphibians, and the mammals and the birds who are endotherms, who can produce their own body heat.
Exactly.
That's why the climate change, you know, a few degrees may not affect us, but the animals who have to precisely regulate their body temperatures each day, it's a big deal.
You know, speaking of that, I have a question for you that's kind of off the wall, but I think you're going to be the one person who understands what I'm talking about. So when we lived in Tucson, we would walk in the mornings, you know, early, especially in the summer as the sun's rising. And whenever we saw a rattlesnake in the suburbs, right? The rattlesnakes were usually around the electrical boxes. And we were just talking about this on a show. And I was going, you know, if you're walking your dogs, everybody be aware of the electrical boxes. So
there's heat.
Is that about heat? Is it about the vibration? What do you think?
It's the electrical energy and the magnetic field that's being put out.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it also tends to be in a nice corner where maybe some residual heat, you know, it is kept. And And it's a good hiding place. You know, those boxes
are a great hiding place.
Yeah, there usually is a water supply nearby.
And that's where the dogs want to go pee-pee. And I'm like, no, don't go pee-pee on the electrical box. There's a snake in there and there's electrical stuff. You don't want to go pee-pee there. Sorry, I know. But it's true. That's where the dogs, the first thing they want to do is go pee-pee on the box because it's, you know.
And that's a problem with reptiles indoors is many of them chew on the electrical cord, probably because there's, you know, the electrical field.
There's
attracts them.
Wow, that's interesting.
But they do have emotion, don't you think so?
Oh, absolutely. And they all have individual personalities. Mm-hmm. They tell people apart. You know, this morning I read scientific article about this guy who did this big research project that could the iguana differentiate between people? Well, anyone who's ever owned a reptile knows that their reptile can tell their person from other people. And I had some abused iguanas that I could describe for you who the person was who abused that iguana based on how the iguana reacted to man versus woman,
girl with brown hair.
Yes, they will recognize, or they, before they get close enough to go, okay, no, that wasn't the person. There's enough of a look that they go, okay, that reminds me of the person who was mean to me.
You look like them. You're wearing a red shirt. Yeah. They always wore a red shirt, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that little tail starts getting ready to whip and the iguana gets ready to run away. So, they can tell people apart.
I know.
I believe that.
Well, snakes, you know, I find snakes everywhere we go. If there's a snake, for some reason, they appear to
like
me.
You.
I dream about them. They're always there. And I used to be scared, but like, because I've always... I should be dead by now by the, you know, the stumbling of, you know, living in Africa. Those snakes are pretty venomous.
They have some pretty interesting snakes
yes,
there.
Yes, mambas and boomslangs and
bush spiders.
Awesome. Yes, all of it. And even in Tucson, I got myself into little predicaments and, you know, but it's, we always got through it. And it was about honor. I don't know. You just kind of have this honor and, you know, I do a dance. Nancy will tell me, like, there's a snake right there. Don't move. Oh, well, next thing you know, I'm dancing and running. But I feel like
just stop.
I feel like they know when, like, in Saguaro National Park, you know, I had a rattlesnake go right over my boots. And I looked at Nancy and said, there's a rattlesnake. And then we went, oh. And then we ended up in a Ramada and the snake did come into the Ramada. And then that wasn't too good.
But when
he went over my feet or she, who cares? He didn't care. I mean, he knew, or she knew, and I was like, "Oh, look
at
you!"
Well, until we were,
and you know, when you forget, when you're so connected in nature, when you're right in it, you forget your fear at times. And then sometimes, like when we've been doing all this swamp stuff lately, alligators and the alligators,
so cool.
People are like, "No, no, no!" They really don't
care. So cool.
They just look at you, and they just,
as long as you stay upright.
And you get away from their babies. Don't go with the baby.
If you wanted to go into the river with the alligator and lie down, you're in trouble.
You're in trouble. But they really
if you're just standing watching, they look at you. You look at them. I don't know what goes on in their mind. I can kind of imagine.
They are amazing. Look at their like they've got all those.
They're so cool.
Chunky scales. I mean, we look at scales on iguanas. I mean, your baby is like amazing. Like that's incredible. But you know, you look at alligators and these are chunky scales. Like that skin.
They're not really scales.
Like we are putting lotions and potions on us as human beings to get rid of scales and, you know, all of that. And they're going, look at me, man. I got the big scales. You don't have any of that.
Leathery skin, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing what they have and how old and ancient they are. Dinosaurs, you know.
Yeah,
how can we not go like, how can we not just amazing? They're amazing. I am so happy hanging with alligators. Just put me there for the rest of my life. That has become my new thing. And it's your fault because we were in Florida when we talked to you first. And I was like, she'll dig this. She'll like this.
Oh, yes.
As we go on.
Absolutely.
Can't we just, as humans, we're supposed to be, we tell ourselves we're smarter than any other species, right?
Allegedly.
We are at the top. We're the top. Okay. So if we are the top of intelligence, can't we be smart enough to understand the cycle of life and make space for every species?
Well, that's part of our education problem.
Right.
You know, is our science education is pretty abysmal right now. Yeah. Parents pass down their prejudices to their kids pass down the prejudices, you know, and so that's why I felt that it was okay that I set the murder mysteries aside to work on books that would help educate people about
what you're doing with kids and teaching them about reptiles. That is a mystery to human beings. Reptiles are a mystery on themselves. I mean, it's like we don't understand their lives, and because we don't understand, we have this fear. So are you feeling, you've written, how many books are you at now? Because I have this long list you sent me, and I'm like, look at, I mean, we in the Zoom background, we only have a few because like I can't fit them on a screen and let it, like seriously, how many books are you at? This is insane.
27.
That's amazing.
I'm waiting for the translation of the 28th to be finished, and then it should be out pretty quickly. I've got two approaching completion. And I've got so many more to write. There are so many more books I have to write.
So how are you doing your illustrations? Are you working with them? Do you have an illustrator that you work with?
I have two locally that I use. They do most of them. When I set a book in a country like the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas, I try to use local artists that it'll bring the flavor and the culture to the books. Yeah. Awesome. So I have used illustrators in different parts of the world and the country as well.
That makes sense.
But I have two locally, primarily Anderson Atlas and Nicholas Thorpe.
Awesome. When you talk about the Cayman Islands, can I go back to alligators? Don't they have crocodiles in the Cayman Islands?
Or no, is it alligators? Do not.
No. Alligators?
Well, caimans, which are a kind of crocodile. Now, there's been a disagreement, discussion. They're not really sure. Because when Columbus first sailed by.
Oh, not him again.
They saw, yes. But he actually did visit the Cayman Islands.
He did do it.
In the Bahamas. They saw large lizard-like reptiles. Now, were they caimans that then became extinct over time, or were they seeing the rock iguanas? And because they had never seen a rock iguana before, went to the next closest animal that they knew, which are the caimans or the crocodiles. So they no longer have, if they did have them, they don't have crocodilians anymore, but they do have the cyclora rock iguanas. And they have two species. One that's on the Grand Cayman, which is the blue iguana, and then the sister isle rock iguana, which is on Cayman Brac and Little Cayman. And one of the scary things, you know, because they are trying to get the green iguanas out of the Cayman Islands as well. If you want to hear a horror story of the green iguanas on Grand Cayman is the poster child for what green iguanas can do. Is they're finding they're hybridizing with the rock iguanas. So along with being outcompeted, we could lose the native iguanas through hybridization.
They're doing it on their own.
Because they are ancient in their DNA.
Iguanas are not ancient. They just look ancient.
So. No,
it's a morphology that it's served well. They're actually only found in the Americas. So they are a relative newcomer.
But what about the ones in Africa that we've
Yeah. Made?
Those are monitor lizards. Those are not iguanas.
Wow.
Iguanas are only found in the Americas and Fiji. Wow.
But monitor lizards look totally different than iguanas.
Yeah, they're not the same.
Yeah, they're very different. It's like talking about a Great Dane and a Chihuahua.
Yeah, yeah.
They're totally different.
So we put them all in the thing because they're like, you're a bunch of lizards. But now the iguanas, and monitors have the same thing. They look like they're wearing earrings. So what?
Okay.
No, they've got what? Those things. No. I'm what? Just putting into context for, you know, no, they're not wearing earrings, but they have these
Thank
big,
you.
Like eerie, like things, these glands, like on their side of their, where you would think they would have ears if they were humans.
They have jowls. The males see, have jowls. Yes.
Those round thingy.
That's pretty, yeah. That's pretty normal.
But some of them have smaller,
normal for humans
smaller
too.
Versus bigger. You know what I mean? They have like little round, depending on the lizard or the iguana or the monitor, they have these little round thingies. Now your dude has he's got big ones.
Yeah, it's a male thing. Okay. But it also has to do with the muscles of the jaw.
They Nancy, have to have come the back strength. Up, it's okay.
You know, depending on what the monitor lizard is eating, you know, if it has something it has to crush, it's going to have bigger muscles, bigger jowls.
But they have like those little markings, like a, almost like a perfect circle, you know, that have. But that's cool. That's neat. I look at that stuff and I go like, dude, what's that? What's with that? You know, do they change
part of the
colors?
Camouflage? Pardon?
Do they change color like with that?
No, only chameleons change color.
Oh, wow. So anoles do a little bit. So they must be part chameleon.
They're called false chameleons because they can change color a little bit, but not to the extent.
Yeah, because they go brown or green from what I've noticed.
Right.
More than like the chameleons in Kenya and South Africa, mostly Kenya. I mean, those were like, that's why we feel they're so ancient, because they have those, it's almost like tusks that they have. Like they're just, they're ancient and their eyes do that.
Yeah, the chameleons are.
Oh my God.
Actually, the chameleons are much older. Yes.
Oh, they're amazing.
They evolved before Africa split apart. So.
Oh, but Africa is the motherland, man. That's it. Chameleons are the motherland.
And they have the chromatophores and the different colors so that they can actually change their color patterns on demand.
I don't know why I'm saying they have tusks, because I know they don't, but they have tusks. I think it's just the way, it's just the way they have, like, not crusty kind of, like they have scaly things. They have markings.
They have bumps and they have little spines.
Yeah.
And,
yes, well, your iguana does. My gosh.
Yeah.
So what's
they
it
live
like
in touching, rocks.
Patches on either side of an iguana, like
that's what I'm talking about,
scaly
with the
little things, but then there will be like a kind of a white patch that's a little larger just above their jowls.
Okay,
like,
so in a green iguana, they have a large scale, and that's called the subtympanic scale. Subtympanic means below the ear.
Sounds like
actually,
a drum.
I know, I was going to go say, eardrum, right?
Eardrums. That's how you can tell it's a green iguana, no matter what color it is, because green iguanas come in many colors, orange, black and white.
Even though they're called green.
So that big thing is...
It's a scale. So that's how you tell it's a green iguana. Only iguana have those. The speculation is that with the dewlap, when the dewlap is extended, which is what they do when they're scared or being defensive, it makes it look like a really big head, so that the scale becomes the eye and then the dewlap.
Oh, I can see that.
I'm five times bigger than you think I am.
Yeah. So, and then,
it'll warn off the predator that this is a really big lizard.
How cool is that?
Oh, that's camouflage. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. I think nature is so amazing with camouflage. We were in Garland, Texas, and Nancy's like, we were sitting out on the patio. And she sees on the tree, she's like, look, is that a snake or a lizard? What is that? It had eyes.
What is this thing?
And we went
it
out
has
and, it,
eyes.
And it turns out was some kind of...
It was a beetle.
A beetle. And when you went up to it, it looked like it was a moth. And it has two eyes
what,
on the back
the
of its
of the
wings.
Beetle?
It was like a crick. It did some kind of dance. I have to go back and look it up.
It
I put
like,
it up on...
It was like 3 inches long and its head was kind of buried in the bark.
Amazing.
But its wings had like a pattern on it, so you would think as you approach it,
it was like eyes, like a snake.
It's like a snake or it's a something looking out at you, a clipper beetle,
something like that. Click beetle. That's right, Nancy.
Yes.
You got it.
Yes.
And it was like,
like
they were copying what a snake would do, or and that's what I've seen in nature a lot is that other animals copy reptiles, so that's again going and using fear from the reptiles into the natural world, uses that as something as part of their defense.
Protection, yes. So, you know, those beetles are probably quite tasty. So they have to pretend to be.
Oh, gosh, I'll just try to eat one next time.
No, Nancy, I don't think so.
The food of the future.
This is amazing, though, what you're doing, because I think what you're getting kids and parents together with books, you know, the whole tablet thing, what's happening in that for children's books? You know, we've got Kindle and stuff like that. So kids' books, are they on Kindle looking at full color? How's it working?
Oh, yeah, wow. It is. And that was a technology that had to develop, because at first Kindle put all the illustrations at the end. Mm-hmm. But as more and more people were creating the picture books, the Kindle technology has caught up. So yes, all my books are on Kindle as well.
So does it make, awesome. Do you see a difference for parents buying books? Are they going more towards Kindle or the hardcover books?
Mostly hard. Well, they're not hardcover, but paper.
Yeah.
Turn the page.
Yeah.
And which is interesting, because I was told that, oh, you know, kids don't read books anymore. Yeah. That's kids read books and they like amazing. To hold them and they
Thank
like
goodness.
To
turn the pages. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. That's great.
I don't believe that kids don't read books. Yeah, I really don't believe
No,
that.
They love it. And tactile. They need to have the tactile. And I think we as humans and you know, parents need that too. We need to put down the screens once in a while and enjoy that fun. And I think that's what's beautiful for children's books are part for the adults to kind of go, you know what, we need to have fun too.
You know? Exactly. Well,
if the kids don't read books, I don't know how they're going to get through school. Mm.
Yeah,
because virtually it's okay, we got that, it'll get better in time, but it's almost like staring at television. You can watch television all night and it's haha, go in, go out. What, how much of it do you retain as opposed to a book?
Right,
there's a difference.
Oh yeah.
And that might go away in time, and I
don't think
not,
so.
But there's something difference between.
Hey, listen, vinyl albums are coming back. So that just proves the whole thing.
Which just blows my mind. Yes.
Yeah. Thank goodness. Thank goodness for that, as far as I'm concerned, because there's nothing like a good vinyl album.
Well, you have
album
to go there music, without, you know? Before you realize what you lost. Mm. Sometimes you just have to go there and go, we're still waiting for CDs to sound as good as vinyl. Sorry, it's not happening. So now we know that. Now go back.
Right.
Go back. Are you, I know that COVID has obviously put a bump in everything. And I know Tucson, the Tucson Festival of Books is a huge deal, especially for the Tucson Sisters in Crime. You guys have a booth there. And I mean, it's a huge deal for authors around the world, actually. So it's coming back up. It's coming.
It is.
It's going to be back. So you'll be there, right?
I will, and I have my own booth as well. Oh. As the Sisters in Crime will have a booth.
Awesome.
I'm called Grab an Adventure by the Tail. So I encourage anybody in the area to come check me out.
Awesome.
I'll be there with one of my illustrators, Anderson Atlas, who's also an author.
Great.
So
do you have a book where like a reptile murders somebody?
No, Nancy.
Not yet. I am toying with an iguana PI who solves mysteries.
I like that better.
That's cool.
None of them are murdered. Well, none of them are murdered so far. We have a near murder. But
dig in the sand, Nancy.
No, I'm just checking.
You never know.
Even my tortoises fight with each other and draw
blood.
They do.
Blood. Oh, yeah, fight with each other.
Astounding.
They do. Animals do just like what humans do. They really do.
Okay, so you have tortoises. So on the undershell, do you have tortoises who have the two little prongs that come out under the neck?
Yes. Most of them do.
What are they?
I, as a child, my dad had tortoises, and
she's going down.
I remember them fighting.
She's gonna go. Do we have to pause? You're gonna bring a tortoise.
Yep, let me just pick her up.
Okay. Hold on, I'm pausing.
Yeah.
So this is the. Okay. Oh okay. Wow, that's a big
See
one.
The two prongs. See, I remember
that's a
that
double
as a kid. Because
who's that? Who is that?
This is Cantata.
Hi, Cantata. Oh, look at she's so pretty.
She's a sulcata tortoise.
Oh, so where's that from? Where?
They're actually, I'm gonna put her down.
Okay.
She's big.
40 pounds.
40 pounds.
40 pounds. Big. And she's the smaller one. I actually have one Duke in the other room is 160 pounds.
No.
At least he was the last time I weighed him.
Let's hear where she comes from. Hold on. Wait. Oh. Wait, go where is she from? Scolata.
She's from sub-Saharan Africa. And these are the ones that are very popular in the pet trade because they hatch at a very nice size, big enough that, and they're really tough and hardy. And they've become the tortoise world because they reach 200 pounds and walk through walls, you know, easily. Because they're used to digging through hard desert soil, they dig really quite easily. So a lot of people, when they get large, start dumping them outside, especially here in the Sonoran Desert, where they do quite well. And they actually outcompete the local Sonoran Desert.
So this is another thing with the pet trade that people need to be aware of, like that, you know, they dump them. And yeah, I mean, we took care of an African tortoise and I just want them to be free. Like, you know, just, it was like, okay, so
free
she gave
in their own place.
And Cantata was abandoned in a house. The realtor who went to sell the house discovered her. And so she contacted her realtor friends asking, you know, do you know of anyone who would take a tortoise? And my neighbors say, oh, we bet we do. And so Cantata came to, but you know, she digs burrows in my backyard that are 30 to 60
to China.
And
she can move an incredible amount of dirt. And it really doesn't matter if the wiring for your electrical system is under there or if you're going through the irrigation system.
She's not gonna care.
No. So you have to do your research.
But the two prongs.
Oh, we're back to
the Are they, no, I just want to know because I used to watch the tortoises fight and I used to notice when they drew in their heads, I'm like, oh, the prongs are coming out. And then I never knew which tortoise was a male or a female because my parents just named them whatever they named them. So I didn't know. If they knew what they were doing, like that's a male, that's female, but the tortoises, and they would use the two prongs in a way and duck their heads in, and the prongs don't get bigger or anything, but they just kind of boom with the prongs. So is it defense, offense, or what?
Combination. It's a protection for the neck because, you know, that is a very easily attacked part of their anatomy. So it does protect the neck, not only from predators, but from normal walking around, running into things, because they tend to just shove through stuff.
But also the males will use them.
We'll use them to flip each other. Because when they battle, you know, it's trying to knock the other guy over to show that you're bigger and tougher.
Dominance.
Yes. Exactly.
Oh, so that's typical male.
You know, boys will be boys.
Well, I wanted to ask this because when we took care of this one tortoise, and I really became friends with him, and he would chase me around the yard because he knew I fed him. I went and got dandelion greens, I had to get organic and all of that. Yeah. But he like would come. I was like, oh my God, don't ever think a tortoise doesn't run. This dude can't move. They really can. It's like people don't think hippos can. Nancy, you've been chased by hippos. It's a real deal. I was like, holy cow. But he also just sat and hung out with me and looked up. And I was like, you know what? I just kept going outside and hanging out with a tortoise. This was cool relationship. So it's the same as like what you're saying with, you know, with the iguanas, you know, don't think they don't have a personality.
They do.
I really liked him. And I wanted to give him water, but she didn't give him water. For a whole week, she goes, no, she gives him a bath and put him in a tub of water, soaks him, and that's it. So
they do get most of their water from their plants. The only time my Sonoran Desert would drink water
is when it was actually actively falling from the sky. Mm. So during monsoon is when she fills up on her water.
Oh, she wants pure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She wants fresh water. You know, I'll fill up basins and no, she didn't care. It has to actually be moving and flowing.
Really?
And this is why you should never pick up a tortoise, especially a desert tortoise of any kind, is because their defense mechanism is to urinate. This is a holdover from reptiles around the world. That's one of their defense mechanisms, is to defecate and urinate. Unfortunately, when a desert tortoise does this, they've now given up their entire year's worth of water supply.
Wow.
And so they will probably die of dehydration.
I've never heard about that. So, yeah. You know, I mean, because we used to live outside Joshua Tree National Park, and you'd see people, you know, pick tortoises up, and people would freak. And then, but it's like, it's going to get hit, you know, so put it on the other side of the road. Maybe not. Like, just stop. Look,
just ease them as quickly as you can to the other side of the road. Don't pick them up, hold them, take your little selfie with them.
Oh, yeah, stop the selfies. Everybody just stop your selfie with the animals.
Can we just say stop the selfies with
that's what
with yourself animals. Forever.
Stop it.
Stop it. Annoying. It's annoying. So annoying.
So we've just seen so much in parks as we travel that it's like we don't seem to have a boundary of understanding. It's a human species doesn't understand leaving wild. There's a balance. And we were up in the Smoky Mountains just, you know, a couple weeks ago and watched people hold their babies in front of elk and get as close and cars clamor around. And I was horrified. I was just like, can't, you know, and came back later when the elk were just kind of calmer when people were gone and they had their babies.
They could actually eat.
They're young.
They could actually eat.
Baby babies, but they were like maybe teens, you know, maybe a year or two old, but they're still young. And people were just clamored around and this couple like, take the photo with the baby, with the elk. And I'm like, what would you do when someone just comes to your house, you're having a barbecue and go, wait, you know what? We're going to come in. We're going to play loud music. We're going to be loud and we're going to take photos and get up right up to your barbecue and put our baby in front of you. You know, it's like, that's how it is. And we've seen so much of it. And I think I think that's what's so important about books like what you're doing with kids, and kids teach parents. And there's something that's unifying with the two getting together, grandparents, parents, aunts, cousins, everybody getting together over a good book is so important. And what you're doing for wildlife, thank you for that. We really appreciate it because it's so necessary. And for what you're talking about with the pet trade, is also important because it's like the first thing is, ooh, I want that. That's when, as soon as you talked about iguanas, Nancy starts shaking her head. She's like, oh my God, oh my God. I'm like, don't worry. I know what's coming next. Elaine's going to tell us it's not what you want to do.
And rock iguanas live 50 to 60 years. So,
do that.
This is a lifetime commitment.
Yeah.
And people don't
knows
do
how
that.
Long they can do that.
They,
you know?
They keep something for 6 months and they're like, okay, that'll work for me. And then, you know, pawn it off somewhere else or just leave it, or the worst of all things is let it loose.
Mm. Yes.
Well, the pet trade thing, that's part of, you know, when we lived out in the desert in Joshua Tree area, 29 Palms, we had a vacant lot on either side of our house. And one day, you know, we had all this wildlife hang out because we had gardens and, you know, we had all the cats, we had the coyotes, we had everybody
all
hang
the feral
out.
Cats.
We basically had like our own park going on in the backyard because we made sure there was water and shade and shelter. You know, we did all the stuff you're supposed to.
And food.
And, but on the, so one day, I think we were actually doing a radio show. We were closing up and I see some guys out there chasing desert iguanas you wouldn't see two women want to go chase some guys and we're like, what are you doing? And they were trapping desert iguanas for the pet store down the road. Now I know California has changed their pet store thing, thank goodness, but this is the point, you know, it's like there's that balance. And I think what you're doing is great because you're going, hello, here's this understanding and love. We saved whales without ever having to see whales, right? Remember, save the humpback whale. Yeah. You could be in the middle of Ohio, never go to the ocean, but because
you can
of
save
books
a whale.
And the entire campaign over it, people stood up to save the humpback whale. It's the same thing. you know, we do not need to own these animals.
No.
And that's what I think people get this. Oh, I want that. It's so cute. Well, no.
Buy a stuffed animal. Not a plush animal. Not a real stuffed
support,
animal.
Support
plush animal.
Conservancies and the nature places. Support them. Oh, yeah. Adopt them virtually.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Help the sanctuaries. And all those rescue sites. So when I say thank you, I really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Yeah.
Everyone, ElaineApowers.com. Have I got your website right?
Yep. ElaineApowers.com.
And LyricPower.net.
.net.
And then you're on Facebook and Instagram. And
YouTube. I have a YouTube channel, either Elaine Powers or Curtis Curly Tail Speaks.
Curtis got the curly tail. Who's got the curly tail?
He's got the curly tails.
Chris has a curly tail.
I see. We love that. All right. Thank everybody again. Also, Tucson Sisters in Crime. Go to TucsonSistersInCrime.org. And if you're in Tucson, go see them at the Festival of Books coming up in 2022. Is it February, March? It's February?
It's March. March 12th. March.
Ah, well, there you go. She knows. Okay. So everyone, check it out. Thanks so much, Elaine.
Thank you.